The reading this morning comes from Psalms chapter 33, 6 through 9. Psalms chapter 33, verses 6 through 9. By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. He gathereth the waters of the sea together as a heap. He layeth up the depth in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spake, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast.
But I want to begin right now with this message by saying to you, I've got some questions, and I need answers. I'm not the only human being that wants answers to these questions. I want to know why I'm here. Not at Leonie Church of Christ. I know why I'm here, but I'm talking about much bigger picture. Why am I even here on the planet? What made God put man on, or did God do that? You see, when you start talking about purpose in life, you have to get back to origins. If there is no divine being behind the creation of the world, there is no divine purpose for my life here on earth. So what am I doing here? Am I just going through the motions of daily living to accumulate some stuff, to get as much stuff as I can get until I die, so I can leave all that stuff behind, and then what? Die and just cease to exist? And so what was the point of everything anyway? Why did I work so hard to get all that stuff just so I could leave it behind to someone else who may squander it? And what am I going to do when I die? Will I even be aware? Am I going out of existence? Or am I going to a new existence? You know, I need some answers. So let's go to the bookstore. Let's all go together. We walk in the bookstore. We see one of the clerks and we call him over and say, hey, can you help us please? We want to know three things. And we want you to take us to the one book in this store that would address all three of these areas. One, we want to know how the world began. I mean, not just speculation, definitive explanation, how the world began. Two, we want to know why the world began. What is the purpose for the world's existence anyway and my place in it? And three, we want to know how the world's going to end. So can you, no, take us to the one book. Well, I've got bunches of books on those subjects. No, we don't want bunches of books. We want one book that would address all. Well, you're not going to find that, he might say. You'll find a bunch of books that deal with origins, but they don't deal with purpose of life. You'll find some that speculate about how the world's going to come to an end, but they don't tell you how it began, and they don't tell you why you're here. So I don't think I've got a book in here. He may not realize that he has a book in there that addresses all three, but he sends us to the library. We go to the local library. We want to know how the world began, why it began, how it's going to end. Take us to the book in your library that addresses every one of those issues emphatically and definitively. I don't think we've got just one volume. Oh, yeah, one more criteria. We want the person that was there when the world began to be the author of this book. We don't want a book that was written by someone that wasn't there when the world began. We want it written by someone that was actually there and knows what happened. Well, you're not going to... Look, he sends us to the Library of Congress. We ask the same questions, and you know where I'm headed with this. We could look through the entire Library of Congress, pull every book down off the shelf, and I'm telling you, there is only one book that would meet the criteria of someone that was there when the world began, someone who knows why the world began, someone who knows how the world's going to end. There is one book that addresses those answers and those questions, and that is this one right here. It's the only one. Need look no further. So let's ask question number one. How did the world begin? We start looking into this book. How far do we have to read before we find out how the world began? In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Genesis 1:1. I know it. The Bible says, someone says, you know, how do you know that's really true? Do you realize how much inspiration packed into one verse there? There was some scientist some years ago in the 1700s, I believe, by the name of Spencer, who came up with this idea that life is made of five basic components: time, force, energy, space, and matter. And that was hailed as such a brilliant scientific discovery. And someone then noted, time, force, energy, space, and matter. In the beginning, time. Force, God. Energy, created. Space, the heaven. Matter, the earth. In the very first verse of the Bible, Moses wrote that God is responsible for it. You say, were you there to see it? No, I wasn't there, but I know things don't build themselves. And this building, I don't know how long it's been here, but I know Hebrews 3:4 establishes a principle that everyone here believes. For every house is builded by some man. Well, who would deny that? One of the elders where I used to preach, we went to St. Louis for a ball game years ago, and during the daytime we needed something to do, so we went to the St. Louis Science Center. I love true science. My wife teaches science occasionally at the school where she's a sixth grade teacher, and so I'm all for true science. And so I was fascinated by some of the exhibits, but I kept noticing they were just determined to get evolution, 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 evolution as the explanation for how the world came to be. I found it fascinating that when we came around one particular corner, there was a bank of video monitors mounted on one blank wall. All that was on that wall were those monitors. I don't know how it looks today, but that was years ago. And if you started on the left-hand side and watched each monitor, you could see the building of the St. Louis Science Center in fast frame fashion from the clearing of the land all the way to ribbon cutting ceremony. And I thought to myself, oh, if I've ever wanted to leave graffiti in my lifetime, it was once and then. I wanted to leave this on that blank wall. For every house is builded by some man, as you can see. But he that built all things is God. Let me ask you a question. Do you believe that God created this world just as he said he did in this book? And you say, well, yeah, I believe God created the world, but I think he did so through millions and millions and millions of years of evolutionary processes. Then you don't believe what God said about how he did it in this book. Because that's not how God said he did it in this book. If you listen carefully to the reading, what did God say about how he did it? By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. Verse 9 says, for he spoke, it was done. He commanded, it stood fast. God said, light be, and light was. Genesis chapter 1. Someone says, preacher, in Exodus 20 and verse 11, it says, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh. You don't seriously believe that this universe was created in 6 literal 24-hour days and that God rested on the seventh. You don't really believe that, do you? I'll tell you what I believe. I believe God is so powerful, he didn't need that much time. Well, wait a minute. What do you mean by that? I mean that if God had wanted to create the world in 60 seconds flat, he could have done it. Do you think God could have created the world in 60 seconds if he'd wanted to, yes or no? Why didn't he? Does it take a week for a divine being to create a world? Is that why? Does it take 6 24-hour days, or is God deliberately pacing the creation to create something else? Time. He created the week. If you ask the evolutionist, where do we get our 7-day week? Wait for a long time before you ever get an answer to that question. There's no scientific reason why a week should be 7 days. None. But there's a perfectly biblical explanation. I know exactly where we got a 7-day week. It was God's deliberate design to build this, make this on the first day, and then to decide to do something else on a separate day, and all up to the sixth day when he made man and woman, rested on the seventh. We asked the evolutionists, do you believe that man came first or that woman came first, and which one evolved first? And they are going to have to do a lot of speculating. I would rather just go by what God says, who was there. He knows what happened. He made man, and then the man was lonely. And Genesis 2 says, God took a rib from that man's side, and he formed a woman, walked her down the aisle, as it were, gave her away to Adam. And Adam said, this is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. And that's where it all happened. Marriage started on that day at that time. And God made the world. And then he gave them procreative powers. And they produced human offspring, males and females. And that's how this continued until this present time. Someone says, preacher, I think you're forgetting something. You're so wrapped up in your Bible, you've missed scientific announcements about the age of the earth. Okay, let's examine those for just a moment. The earth is allegedly multiplied billions of years old. Some would say it's billions. Okay, let me just ask this question. If I take this book at face value, and I have no reason not to, it's proven itself to be beyond human production in so many ways. If I take this book at face value, am I going to believe that God created the world in six literal 24-hour days? Yes. You know how I know that 6 days is not six epochs of time equaling millions of years each in length? Look at Exodus 20 with me for just a moment at the words leading up to verse number 11. In Exodus chapter 20, look at verse 9 beginning. This is Moses talking to the people. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. Stop. If they were to understand 6 days in verse 9, would they have said, Moses just told us that we're supposed to work for millions of years each over six epochs of time? Or would they have understood this to be a normal 6 day period? 6 days defines normal 24-hour days in verse 9. And then in verse 11, 4 in 6 days. How has 6 days already been used in this context in a normal, ordinary sense? In 6 days, the Lord made heaven, earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh. Let me tell you a little bit about the dating method just real quickly. Here it is. Do you want to know why they say the earth is as old as they claim it is? We say, come here, we want to ask you a question. How do you know the earth's that old? Well, we know that by the fossils that we found. Okay? How do you know the fossil you found is as old as you say it is? We know that by the sediment where we found the fossil. All right? How do you know the sediment where you found the fossil is as old as you say it is? I'm not making this up, dear friends. How do we know the sediment is as old as we say it is? We know that by the fossil that we found in it. I thought you said you knew the age of the fossil by the sediment where you found it. That's right. How do you know the age of the sediment where you found it? By the fossil. Do you see what's going on here? Circular reasoning. You let them assume one thing to prove another thing, and they can get by with that all day long. I tell you, the eureka moment for me, and I'm simple-minded, I look for the simplest way to understand something, and once I get a hold of it, I latch on to it. And this for me was the simplest thing. I'd never thought about it until years ago, and I'm probably the last one to figure it out, but I love to pass it on for others that may be looking for a simple way not to be intimidated by the billions and millions of years numbers that are thrown out at us by some of the scientific community. If I take this book at face value, God created Adam on the sixth day, correct? When God created Adam, according to the Genesis account, did God create Adam as a helpless little baby that needed a mama to nurse him and to bring him up into adolescence and then on into adulthood? Is that the way the book of Genesis depicts Adam? on the first day of Adam's existence, was he a baby or was he a grown man able to dress and keep a garden? Now, I became a member of the grandparent fraternity on November 21st of last year. And yes, I do have pictures. I'll be glad to show you. You know what our grandson's name is? Just so happens his name is Adam. All right? 5 days after Adam was born, he didn't have whiskers, and he wasn't walking upright, and he wasn't naming animals, and he was not equipped to do anything at 5 days old except scream and cry and sleep a little bit and cool a little bit. That's it. Not much more than that. I want to ask you, 5 days after God created Adam, in the book of Genesis, that Adam, the first Adam, 5 days after God created Adam, how old was he? 5 days old. How old did he appear to be? 5 days after God made Adam, how old did he appear to be? He appeared to be hundreds or thousands of times older than he actually was. So wait a minute, if God could build the appearance of age into a human being, could he build the appearance of age into the universe? Yes or no? Could he make it ready for operation on the first day that he made something? Yes. He created everything mature and full grown. And so the appearance of age was built in. So whatever age they want to throw at me, I'm just going to say, well, that may be how old it appears to be, but actually, it's not as old as it looks. Just like Adam wasn't as old as he looked. So I know that God made the world. The Bible's clear on that. You say, well, I don't know if I... Yes, you do. You know. There are certain things in this building right now that no atheist in the world would think are just accidental chance and happenstance. There's a contraption right here pointing to an area behind me where a screen can come down from the ceiling area and come down here, and there's a connection between why that projector is pointing here instead of back in that corner on the left-hand side of the building from me. Well, how did that get up there anyway? Is there any atheist in the world that would walk in here and see that bolted to the ceiling and see the screen hanging down and say, necessity caused that to evolve over time. Eventually, kaboom, an explosion created this whole scenario that we're seeing here. An explosion did that. No one in their right mind would buy that. Now, I tell this story sometimes, and when I do, I can tell some people think, who did we invite for this meeting? This man's out of his mind. But sometimes you have to demonstrate how absurd something is by being intentionally absurd. So let me ask you, young people, do we have any young people in here? Yes, we do. How many of you like cake? Do you like cake? Do you like your favorite? Okay, what's your favorite cake? Imagine you come in and there on the kitchen counter is your very favorite cake. It is baked and iced with your very favorite frosting, and your name is written across the top of that cake. It's definitely for you. You think, Mom, thank you for baking my favorite cake. And your mom says, darling, I love you, but I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't bake you a cake. Now, in my family, my children would not run to me and say, Daddy, thank you for baking my favorite cake. That's not a possibility. Cheerios, maybe, but not a cake, okay? Okay, your brother and sister didn't bake it for you. Mom and Dad didn't bake it. Dad calls the family meeting. He says, I've been trying to figure that the origin of this cake out all day long. It's been on my mind. It's bothered me. And then suddenly it just hit me. It's so clear, so simple how it happened. You know, I heard that we're living in an area where there's like some earthquake type activity that goes on from time to time. It's plain as day. While we were all away from the house, there must have been a rattling of the house by some kind of earthquake that caused a mixing bowl to start working its way out of one of the cabinets. And the mixing bowl fell on the counter, fortunately right side up. And there was an explosion caused by a gas main or something that burst, and kaboom, here comes the refrigerator door flying open, and here come eggs flying out of it. And of all the places in the whole kitchen those eggs could have gone, we're very fortunate they happened to smash on the cabinet right above the mixing bowl and dripped into the mixing bowl, but no eggshell got in somehow. Isn't that fortunate? All the ingredients necessary for the baking of a cake, kaboom, collided in midair as a result of an explosion and landed in the mixing bowl. Daddy, how did the contents of the mixing bowl get into a cake pan and get into the oven and then get taken out and frosted and iced? And, well, young people, listen, whenever you can't figure out something, an explosion explains everything. There was an explosion, at which time that mixing bowl went flying through the air and a cake pan came flying out of its location, collided with the mixing bowl. Now the mixing bowl's upside down, emptying its contents into the cake pan right there on the kitchen floor. Well, Dad, if cakes don't bake themselves sitting on the kitchen floor with a mixing bowl right smack dab in the middle of the cake pan, well, did you not hear what I said earlier? Whenever you can't explain anything, kaboom! An explosion explains it all. There's another explosion. The cake pan and the mixing bowl are no longer combined. They're separated. And the oven door comes flying open and an explosion sends the cake pan flying in. Daddy, who turned the oven on? Above the oven, there's some mason jars in a cabinet. Shaking, quaking. Mason jar falls toward the floor. Fortunately, knocks the knob to the bake setting. Another mason jar falls toward the floor, knocks the temperature knob of, fortunately for us, of all the temperatures it could have accidentally knocked it to just the temperature needed to bake a cake. Daddy, who took the cake out of the oven? When the oven is just right and the cake is just as moist as... Children, did you not hear? Kaboom, here comes the frosting flying out of the refrigerator. The frosting smothers the cake. I don't really know how it wrote your name on it yet. I'm still working on that one. But that's how it happened, boys and girls. Everyone that can see anything knows that. Mama, do you want to call 911 or should one of us kids call 911? Daddy has lost his mind. How many of you think that sounds like a perfectly rational explanation for where that cake came from? I want to know who cleaned up the mess, don't you? You say, well, you didn't ever explain, you didn't give us a rational explanation where I can give you an easy rational explanation where the cake came from. Grandma. There you go. Grandma did it. That makes perfect sense and doesn't require me to buy into all of this nonsense. Friends, if a cake has to have a baker, man has to have a maker. It's as simple as that. God made us, and that's where we came from. Okay, second thing, why are we here even? What did God put us on the planet for? What's the reason? Well, you know, there's a man by the name of Solomon who's trying to figure all that out, and he wrote it down in an inspired diary for us called Ecclesiastes. And I'm reading about his quest and his search for fulfillment, and I see him saying, you know what, maybe wisdom, earthly wisdom, no, that didn't do it. So in chapter 2, verse 1 of Ecclesiastes, I said in mine heart, go to now, I'll prove thee with mirth. I got it. Every morning the whole quest of my life is to enjoy pleasure. I'm going to just make pleasure the joy of my life. The whole focus of my life is pleasure, enjoy pleasure. How's that working for you, Solomon? Behold, this also is vanity, it's emptiness. I tried to laugh my way through life, he says in verse 2. What good does that do? I tried wine. Oh, I thought maybe I could drink wine and find the satisfaction of my heart. Verse 3, that didn't work. So I became a workaholic. Verse 4, I had houses in the plural. That didn't work. They were beautifully landscaped properties too. Gardens, orchards, vineyards, oh. pools of water to water the wood to bring forth the trees. I still was looking for something else. You know what? I actually had servants. I didn't have to do anything I didn't want to do. I said to my servants, you do it. I had servants, verse 7, and I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all in Jerusalem before me. I had silver and gold, antique treasures of kings and provinces. If I wanted a concert, I just command concert. Bring in my men singers and my women singers and have them put on a command performance for the king. I was great, verse 9, increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem, and I was smart on top of it. And if I saw something I wanted, verse 10, whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them, I didn't withhold my heart from any joy. My mom used to watch QVC and all these shopping channels when she was alive. She never bought anything, hardly ever. I asked her one day, I said, why do you watch these channels when you know you can't afford the items that are on the screen? She said, I just like watching. Now, let me ask you this question. Have you ever thought to yourself, oh, if I could ever have enough money to buy anything I wanted the moment I wanted it, I'd finally know the whole real meaning of life? I asked this question one time in a service, and I ask it this way, and young people listen more than we give them credit for sometimes in the worship service. They're tuned in even when they don't seem to be sometimes. And I said, if you could ever get to the point where you had so much money, you could buy anything you wanted the moment you wanted it, would you truly be happy? And this voice from the auditorium said, uh-huh. This little boy was there to tell everyone, yes, I would be the happiest. No more trips to Walmart and mom saying, we can't afford that. That's the way he's thinking. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever seen a car on a car lot that you thought, boy, I like that car, but I don't like that sticker. I can't afford that car. You drive by that house up on the hill and you think, oh, if I could choose any house in the world in which to live, that would be mine. I love that house. I love it. Let's say you had enough money to buy any car you wanted, any house you wanted, any wardrobe you wanted, anything you wanted, would you finally be happy, yes or no? Solomon, help us. He said in verse 11, I looked on all the works my hands had wrought, the labor I'd labored to do. It was all grasping for the wind. He says, vanity and vexation of spirit. I've got it. Okay, open up your hand, Solomon, and show us what you captured. I'm like grabbing for air. There's nothing to it. There's nothing substantive that lasts. And Solomon, I bet you're the happiest guy on the planet, right? Look at verse 17 of Ecclesiastes 2. Therefore, I hated life. Now, if you could make $666 million a year, which is what someone guesstimated Solomon would have been worth in his time, I don't know how to calculate all those things, but if you could make $666 million a year, would you be happy? Someone says, just give me $66 million a year. I'll be very happy. Someone else says, I tell you what, $6 million a year will do me fine. Really? How many true Hollywood stories have you seen where this fellow or this woman thinks, oh, this is the happiest? No. I used to preach in South Haven, Mississippi, which is 5 miles from Elvis's Graceland mansion across the state line. One Sunday morning, I preached a sermon on 1 Timothy 6 and how Paul says, we brought nothing into this world and it's certain we can carry nothing out. 1 Timothy 6, 7. Talked about how covetousness and a desire for riches, the love of money, pierces many through with many sorrows. Spent time in that text. And then I told the following. I said, when Elvis Presley was alive, he had an interview with a magazine reporter in which Elvis made the following statement, quote, sometimes I believe I'm the most miserable man on earth. And the reporter's like, come on, Elvis. You're the most miserable man? with your 20-plus room mansion that we're sitting in for this interview, and your limousine outside waiting to whisk you to your private jet to take you to some exotic destination, and you have gold and platinum records all over your walls, and beautiful women think you're attractive, and you are miserable? Yeah, okay. Yeah. You're what everyone else wants to be. You wouldn't take it back. Well, that Tuesday night, I went to visit a couple that had been to our services for the first time on that Sunday morning, and I just wanted to drop by and say, thanks for coming. I hope you'll come back. They were so excited to see me. The lady says, come on in, come in, come in. And then I'm sitting down. She says, we hadn't been to church in 17 years. And the first Sunday we decided to go to church, you preached on Elvis. Wasn't that amazing? Well, yeah, it was amazing to me because I didn't think I'd preached on Elvis. I'd preached on 1 Timothy 6, 7 to 17, and used one illustration about Elvis in the process. I said, why did that illustration about Elvis stick with you so much? She said, oh, Gene here, that's Elvis's first cousin. Gene's mother and Elvis's mother were sisters, and I married Gene, and we used to live at Graceland upstairs. And can I be honest with you? It's not every day you meet someone that claims they lived at Elvis's house. And I didn't know these people. And so frankly, when they're telling me, yeah, we used to live at Graceland with Elvis, I'm thinking, whoa, I need to get out of here as soon as I can. These people are not grounded in reality. Bless their hearts, they think they lived at Elvis's mansion. And then she pulls out the photo albums. Here we are on the set of Jailhouse Rock, and here we are at this, and I'm thinking to myself, this is long before the days of Photoshop. This really is them, this really is Elvis. And then Gene said this, you really took me down memory lane with that illustration you told Sunday morning. I said, why is that? He said, Elvis would allow those of us who lived at the mansion to sit in on interviews if we didn't interfere. He said, I was in the room when that interview was conducted in which Elvis said he was miserable. You have no idea how much that reporter tried to get him to take it back. It's supposed to be a puff piece about how great it would be to be Elvis. And Elvis never would backtrack on the statement. You know what's interesting to me? It doesn't seem like some of us ever get the memo. We think, oh, if I could just make this number of dollars, I'd finally be happy. And then lo and behold, we start making X number of dollars, and we're not happy. We think, I need a little more than that. If I could make this much, I'd be happy, okay? And then we start making that much. But our spending increases because we now have more, and now we're saying, I need more, I need more. Look, Solomon, did you ever figure out why you're... Yes, I did figure it out. And I want to write it down as the conclusion to my inspired diary, Ecclesiastes 12. Let's hear the conclusion of the whole matter, verse 13. You ready for why you're here? Ready? Fear God, keep His commandments. This is the whole of man. The word duty is italicized, supplied by the translators. You don't do any violence to the text by just reading it this way. Fear God and keep His commandments. This is the whole of man. That's why you're here. That's why I'm here. Because God's going to bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Which brings me to the final question. Now that I know where I came from God, and now that I know why I'm here, to fear God, keep His commandments, how's this world going to end, and then what happens to me when it does? My Bible is so clear on this. In Matthew 25 and verse 46, it comes down to one of two destinies. That's it. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. It's simple. There is a heaven, there is a hell. Heaven is life eternal. Hell is everlasting punishment. Yes, those places are still real. By the way, I was invited to speak at this very church years ago. And I mean years ago. I think this was back in the mid-2000s. There was a lectureship here. And my assigned subjects were, who believes in hell anymore? And changing attitudes about hell. I spoke on both of those subjects. I don't remember there being any responses that night. But years later, a young man came up to me at the lectureship at another place, and he said, you don't know me, but you came and preached at my home congregation, and you preached on hell, and I wasn't faithful at the time, and my parents gave me a copy of the CD, and I listened to it in my truck. And as you described hell, I shook with the recognition that that's where I was headed. I have repented. I went to a school of preaching, and I've become a gospel preacher. And I just wanted to tell you about it. I was not aware of any responses that night, and you never know where responses are going to come from. I want you to know something. I'm here this week not just to fill a slot, not just to say, okay, we had a meeting like we do every year. Next year we'll have another one. I really believe you believe. Souls still need to be saved from a devil's hell and given the opportunity to go to a wonderful place called heaven, right? Isn't that what this life is all about? Getting ready for the next life? And fortunately, we have a GPS that gives us exactly the directions we need to take to get there. This is the GPS gospel plan of salvation that we can use to go by. I close as I start giving you God's directions. The importance of believing directions that are actually factual became very evident to me many years ago when I was holding a meeting in Kentucky. And Saturday night before the service on Sunday, I got online and I checked three different websites for the directions to the church building. And for good measure, I punched it into my little portable GPS in my car. And they all matched. They all had the same exact directions as to how to get from where I was staying to where I was worshiping the next day, preaching. So having quadruple checked it, I left with supreme confidence that I was headed to the right place. And I got to the place where the voice said, you've reached your final destination. And I looked and saw nothing but a clump of trees. I thought, well, maybe the church building's on the back side of those trees. And I tried to follow a road around, but it dead-ended, and I wasn't able to go back beyond those trees. And I'm looking in vain for through the trees, trying to spot a church building, looking for roads and side roads. And I wasn't smart enough to bring the phone number with me to the brother that had given me the invitation to the meeting. And so I'm wandering around looking for the church building when my phone rings. Brother Clark? Yes. Are you all right? No. I'm lost. Well, where are you? Well, I just drove by a sign just now that said such and such state park. Brother Clark, you're 35 miles from us. 35 miles? Well, yeah, when you turn and go 17 miles in the wrong direction and have to drive 17 miles back, and then go 17 miles in the right direction. Yeah. He said, we'll just sing till you get here. Okay. I was very embarrassed. But you know what? I don't think the people at Google Maps and Rand McNally and MapQuest and Garmin all got in a room somewhere and said, let's get B.J. Clark. They don't know me. They don't know me. So wait a minute, those directions were wrong, yes. But they were presented as if they were right, yes. And if you sincerely believe in your heart that you're following the right way, you will be following the right way, right? Not necessarily right at all. Jacob, do you sincerely believe in your heart Joseph is dead? The Bible says, Jacob said, without doubt, Joseph's rent to pieces. Genesis 37:33. He believed without a doubt that Joseph was rent to pieces by a wild animal. He was wrong. You can sincerely believe that you're on the right road because you've said the sinner's prayer and you've asked Jesus to come into your heart, the direction someone gave you. And you sincerely believe those directions, and three other people you saw gave those same directions. I want to ask you a question, friends. If one person gives wrong directions and three other people give the directions that they were given by that guy, who's going to be wrong? Everyone that's heard those wrong directions. You want good directions this morning? Peter, when they ask you what to do on the day of Pentecost to be saved, that would have been a perfect opportunity for you to say, everyone, bow your heads. Everyone, bow your heads, okay? As soon as you all have your heads bowed, I will now lead you in the sinner's prayer, and you can ask Jesus to come into your heart and make Him the Lord of your life, and you'll be saved. And about 3,000 said the sinner's prayer and asked Jesus to come into their heart. Do you read that in your Bible in Acts chapter 2, yes or no? All right, if you don't, what do you read? Then Peter said unto them, repent and be baptized, every one of you, in the name of Jesus Christ, for the remission of sins. About 3,000 did that, and they were added to something. To what were they added? The Lord's church. The church you read about in the New Testament. My friends, you want to figure out the basics of life? The word Bible, someone said, basic instructions before leaving earth. B-I-B-L-E, basic instructions before leaving earth. It tells me, gives me basic instruction about where I came from, in the beginning God. It tells me why I'm here, fear God, keep His commandments. It tells me how the world's going to end. It's going to be annihilated, not renovated, annihilated. 2 Peter chapter 3, it's going to melt with fervent heat. It's the earth and the works that are therein shall be burned up. And then what? You've only got two choices, heaven or hell. And those shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous will go into life eternal. Our goal is to see someone go to heaven this week that wasn't ready to go yet. We hope that if you were on the road to heaven and you got off and took an exit back to the Broadway that leads to destruction, you'll turn around and get back on the path that leads to life. We love you. If you want to become a Christian, the New Testament's quite clear about how to do it. People who heard Jesus preach said, I want to say that I believe Jesus Christ, the Son of God. If I don't, I'll die in my sins, John 8:24. I'll confess His sweet name as I'm commanded to do, and I'll do it unto salvation, Romans 10:9-10. And I'll do it as a penitent confessing believer, Acts 17:30. All men everywhere have been commanded to repent. And then what? I'll do what Peter told those folks to do. I'll be baptized for the remission of sins. And God will add me to His church. And I can live for Him so that I can someday live with Him. We love you. We hope you will answer the basic question of life. What will He do with you is going to depend on what you do with Him right now. As together we stand and sing, won't you please come to Jesus?